7. When I left the trailer, Brody noticed I was limping. My lower back was still aching and messing up my entire gait, and he suggested I follow their access road out to the highway. "No offense," he said, "but you don't look like you're in any shape to climb out the gorge." I took his suggestion. The route was long and quite a bit out of my way, and I didn't make it back to Mom and Dad's restaurant until nearly 2 o'clock. I was backing out of my parking space when the door to the restaurant opened, and my friend, the bartender, stepped outside. He recognized my Jeep, then squinted at me through the windshield and gave me a puzzled wave. I waved back, grateful to be in motion, so I wouldn't have to stop and explain why I'd parked there. Back at Osprey Cove, there were a half dozen cars waiting to enter the camp, a long line of new guests arriving for the wedding. The security team was stopping every vehicle to check IDs and collect signatures, so I settled in for a long wait, but then Hujo recognized me and came trotting over, insisting that I get out of my Jeep. "Margaret's been asking for you. It's her big weekend, and you should be with your daughter, not waiting for my team to do their job." He was already opening my door, so I couldn't refuse him. "Thank you, Hujo. I appreciate it."
"No problem, Mr. Zatowski. Did you find what you needed in town?"
I realized I was empty-handed, that I hadn't brought back any kind of bag, and from the way Hujo smiled, I think he knew he'd caught me in a lie. "I found more than I expected," I told him. "Has there been any news on the girl?"
"What girl?"
I couldn't believe he had to ask. "The dead one? Gwendolyn."
"Oh, no, sir. I don't think we'll hear anything until next week."
Then he lowered his voice. "But since you are family, I will share some confidential information. The police found Xalazine in her suitcase. You're probably not familiar with the name, but it's a deplorable drug, much more dangerous than heroin or even fentanyl. Some kind of animal tranquilizer used by farmers, but for the girl's sake, Mr. Gardner wants to keep that information private." I turned over my keys and followed Main Street back inside the camp. Now that the guests were arriving in force, Osprey Cove had taken on a whole new level of energy. The landscapers and housekeepers had moved out of sight, and all that remained were the fruits of their labors. Trees and flower beds popping with color, well-swept walkways, and immaculately clean cottages. Guests were everywhere, unpacking their cars, swinging in hammocks, whipping frisbees, and greeting friends with hugs and high fives. It seemed like cocktail hour was already underway because everyone was holding a wine glass or plastic cup. No one seemed to be acknowledging that a woman had died here, that a body was found with two curious bruises, and an investigation was still pending. I was passing a cottage nicknamed Woodpecker when a young woman came bounding down the steps, waving to me.
"Mr. Zatowski, it's Min from Babson College."
She threw her arms open wide, revealing a Babson College sweatshirt.
"Do you remember me?"
Of course I remembered her. Min and Maggie were roommates all 4 years of college. They'd been randomly matched by a computer, but grew into close friends and joined the same sorority. She'd always struck me as a sweet girl and a loyal friend, and I was thrilled to finally reconnect with a person from Maggie's past. She greeted me with a hug, and I thanked her for coming.
"Well, if you think I'd miss this wedding, you don't remember me very well. I can't believe the size of this place."
She explained that she was recently married herself and waved over her new husband, Brian. If you told me he was still in high school, I would have believed you. He had bright eyes and an impish smile, and he seemed completely enamored of his new wife. I noticed that he reached for her hand in a gesture that seemed reflexive. They'd been married a little over a year, but still looked and sounded like giddy lovebirds on their honeymoon.
"It's a funny thing, Mr. Zatowski. I was just telling Brian about Babson College and all those lousy admins, ready to throw Maggie under the bus. They were all so mean to her. Do you remember?" But I'm making a prediction. After this weekend, I bet all those same deans and provosts will be knocking on her door and asking for donations. And I hope Maggie tells them to go to hell.
She laughed at her own joke, but I had trouble seeing the humor in the subject. I told her I didn't really like to think about it.
Well, I promise Babson has already forgotten. Their annual giving office has a very short memory. She'll make the cover of their alumni magazine before she turns 30. I guarantee it.
One of the biggest regrets of my life was sending Maggie out of state for college. You have to remember that I joined the U.S. Army right out of high school, so when it came time to file Maggie's applications, we were both flying blind. I wanted my daughter to go to Penn State so she'd be close by in the event of an emergency. But Maggie argued that Nittany Lions were a dime a dozen. She said she needed to attend a more prestigious school to have a competitive advantage, and she quickly identified Babson as a feeder school to Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Bank of America, and other Fortune 500 companies. The tuition was ridiculous, but I could afford it, and I wanted her to have every advantage that money could buy. Her grades were fantastic, all straight A's, and she rushed the college's most popular sorority for business majors, which exposed her to a vast network of professional contacts. The problems started halfway through Maggie's senior year, when a sister named Jessica Sweeney got in trouble for selling test answers. She was dragged in front of the Board of Academic Integrity, and instead of taking responsibility like a mature adult, she tried to pin all the blame on Maggie, claiming that Maggie was the real mastermind of the operation and Jessica was merely an assistant. Most of the sisters united behind Maggie, but two insisted that Jessica was telling the truth. And the rest of the semester was an all-out civil war, with accusations and threats flying back and forth. Maggie called me crying every night. I'd never heard her sound so frightened and hopeless and terrified. And I was three states away, unable to help. I begged her to talk to a therapist, and I hired her a lawyer to help sort everything out. In the end, my daughter was completely exonerated, and Jessica Sweeney left the school in disgrace. But the experience ruined college for Maggie, and she refused to walk at her own graduation ceremony.
"I'm sorry she had to go through all that," Min said. "But do you know something? I think the experience made her stronger. I bet no one messes with her anymore."
I wasn't so sure about this last part. In fact, after hearing Linda Taggart's story, I was more certain than ever that Maggie was being played, and she was going to need my help to make things right. I told Min and Brian that I would see them at dinner, and then I walked down to Osprey Lodge in search of my daughter. The catering team was already hard at work on the main lawn, assembling twice as many tables and chairs as they'd brought the night before, and now the beach was full of sunbathers, beautiful young people with bronzed skin, sprawled out on lounge chairs, scrolling through their phones and sipping on piña coladas. There were more of them out in the water, swimming and paddleboarding and kayaking in the cove. I moved just close enough to make sure none of them was Maggie, then followed the path around the lake until I was back at my cottage.
"There you are," Tammy exclaimed. "Where the heck have you been?"
She and Abigail were sipping iced tea on the porch. Their faces were slightly pink with sunburn, as if they'd spent the whole afternoon outdoors. "I had to run to the drugstore."
"Why?"
Tammy asked. "It doesn't matter. What did I miss?" According to my sister, they had been enjoying the most wonderful afternoon. First, they all hiked to the top of Cormorant Point, where the views were glorious and the lunch was exquisite.
"Best potato salad I've ever tasted," Tammy said, before miming a chef's kiss.
Then Errol Gardner himself took them out on the lake in his speedboat so that Abigail could learn how to water ski.
"Maggie came too, and we had a wonderful time."
Abigail seemed a little less enthused.
"I wanted to canoe," she explained. But Errol said water skiing was funner, so that's what we did. And I haven't even told you the best part, Tammy continued. After we came off the lake, Errol said he had something for me. She lowered her voice. Like a kind of wedding gift, because I played such a big role in bringing up Maggie.
And only then did I realize my sister was holding a thick sheaf of papers in her lap. They were bound in a navy blue folder, embossed with gold foil letters, like something you'd receive from a bank.
This is 1,000 shares of capacity stock in my own private brokerage account that Jerry set up for me. He's going to wire the transfer on Monday after we're back in Stroudsburg. Isn't that the most generous thing you've ever heard of?
Last time I checked, capacity stock was trading for $262 per share. The gift was more money than my sister earned in the last 5 years combined.
And don't hold me to this, Tammy continued in a low whisper, but I'm pretty sure you're getting some too.
There was no time to elaborate because Maggie was emerging from our cottage with a glass of lemonade.
Dad, where have you been?
I'm glad you're here. Can I talk to you?
What is it this time?
In private, I said. I'm sorry, Maggie. I hate to ask you again, but it's really important.
She seemed exasperated by the request, but followed me down a path to the lake anyway. I wanted to walk even farther, just to make sure Tammy and Abigail couldn't hear us. But Maggie insisted we'd gone far enough.
We're already miles from civilization, she said. What is this very urgent, super private thing we need to discuss?
You're not going to like what I have to say, but I need you to promise to listen and really hear me, okay?
She exhaled and then smiled to show she was still keeping an open mind.
Yes, Dad, you have my complete attention. What is it?
I drove into town this afternoon. I met Dawn's family.
She opened her mouth to reply, and nothing came out. The news had left her speechless.
I wanted to hear their side of the story. You told me they were crazy, but I don't think they are. I think they're telling the truth.
She stepped closer to the lake, putting some extra distance between us. She seemed ready to jump in the water and start swimming.
Please tell me you're joking, Dad. Please don't say you went to meet them the day before my wedding.
I think you should hear Linda's story. She wasn't drunk and she's not crazy. Something bad happened here.
All my language seemed to wound her. She was gesturing wildly with her hands, like she was trying to shield herself from my nonsense.
Dad, if I knew you were going to do this, I never would have invited you here. You're making me wish I never called you. Why can't we just have a nice weekend?
I told Maggie the basics of what Linda Taggart had told me, how she'd traced her daughter's journey to Osprey Cove using the GPS app on her smartphone, monitoring her activity at the camp until the blue dot disappeared.
How do you explain that, Maggie?
The explanation is she's lying. She's making it up.
No, Maggie, I think you're lying.
She gaped at me like she'd been slapped, but there was no turning back now.
I think you love Aiden very much, and you want to protect him. So you lied to the police and told them that he spent the weekend in your apartment, and maybe everyone here believes you. But I'm your father, and I know how to read your cues. I have never believed this story. You're hiding something.
That's a great thing to hear, Dad. Thanks for sharing that with me. But now, let me ask you, what secret do you think I'm hiding? Is Aiden a serial killer? Is he murdering women at Osprey Cove? Oh my God, did he murder Gwendolyn too? Is that what you think? Have I fallen in love with Jeffrey Dahmer?
I don't know, Maggie. I don't know what to believe.
She screamed at me.
That was sarcasm. He's not Jeffrey Dahmer. What the hell is wrong with you?
I struggled to keep my voice from rising because I didn't want to match her volume. I didn't want to yell. Maggie, you have to agree there is something very weird about this place. Just last night, a woman died, and now your co-workers are building sandcastles where her body washed up.
The police found drugs in her suitcase, something called xylazine.
Yes, I heard that, but tell me something else. Have you seen Catherine Gardner yet? Has she come out of her locked room?
She's sick. How many times do I have to say it?
And what about Aiden? Where is he? I haven't seen him in 24 hours.
Here we go again.
I think you should take a pause, Maggie. Make sure you want to be on this train.
There are 200 people at the camp right now, and another 100 coming tomorrow. The train's already left the station.
No, it hasn't. The train doesn't leave until tomorrow. You still have time. Just look at all the question marks. Gwendolyn, his mother, the photo of Don Taggart. And then, all of a sudden, Maggie seemed to remember something, and all the tension drained from her body. She relaxed and started to laugh. And I was foolish enough to believe that maybe I had finally reached her. What's so funny?
I just realized something, Maggie said. You were gone all afternoon, so you don't know about the photo. The one you received in the mail. I wish I had it with me.
As it turns out, I had a copy in my pocket. I'd asked Linda Taggart to print it before I left her house, and she'd run it off using the equipment in Don's bedroom. I removed the sheet of paper from my back pocket and unfolded it.
Jerry sent a scan to his office so his interns could analyze it. They have special software they can use to calculate the shadow length and whatnot. But turns out they didn't need it. One of the interns spotted the flub right away.
Maggie pointed to the photo of Aiden, looking 15 pounds heavier, and smiling with a lightness of spirit I'd never seen in person. I didn't understand what I was supposed to be noticing.
His hands, Maggie said. Look at his hands.
His left arm seemed fine. It hung at his side, and his left hand looked normal. His right arm was wrapped around Dawn's waist, and he was resting his right hand on her hip. And I still didn't see the problem, so Maggie had to point me to it.
Look at his thumb, she said. Don't you see it?
And at last, I realized what she meant. His right thumb was on the wrong side. In the photograph that Linda Taggart shared with me, Aiden Gardner was a man with two left hands. 8. We rehearsed the ceremony in the Globe, an old outdoor theater constructed by the original summer camp. It was deep in the woods and hidden by tall trees, a deep crater ringed by wooden benches with a stage in the center. It had the feeling of a sacred space, a kind of secret sanctuary deep in the forest, and it might have been quiet and peaceful if there weren't so many people hanging around. I'd assumed the rehearsal would be a private affair for the bride and groom and family, but several dozen guests had come to watch, many with glasses of wine or small plates of food, like this was just the next stage of the weekend entertainment. I was disappointed that no one chased them off. At the base of the stage were four women in black dresses with violins and violas. They were tuning their instruments and arranging their sheet music with quiet, well-practiced efficiency. I was watching them set up when a young man with wild curly hair approached and pulled me into a hug.
Hey, Dad. It's great to meet you. Are you ready for this? I'm RJ, and I'll be hosting the ceremony.
He was dressed in chinos and sneakers and a yellow t-shirt advertising Kodak film. You're hosting? Are you a pastor?
Sometimes it feels that way, but no. I work in human resources with Errol and Margaret.
He explained that he also dabbled in stand-up comedy and taught improv on Saturday afternoons, so he was accustomed to working a room. He'd paid a $65 fee to a website to become an ordained minister, strictly for the purposes of officiating Margaret and Aiden's ceremony. "Now, do me a favor," he said. "Can you point me to the groom? Because I want to say hello before we start." Aiden was sitting on a bench with three other young men, his groomsmen, I would later learn, all colleagues from Mass Art, and he looked a little sickly, almost feverish. His face was pale and clammy, and some kind of rash had broken out on his forehead, a sprinkling of little red dots. RJ greeted him with a double fist bump. "My man," he exclaimed. "How are you, my brother?" Errol Gardner arrived with Jerry and Sierra and copious apologies for his wife's absence. He told everyone that Catherine was still feeling poorly, but expressed confidence she would be ready to rock for the big ceremony Saturday afternoon. Meanwhile, Tammy showed up with Abigail to practice her flower girl duties. But instead of sitting with us and waiting patiently for the rehearsal to start, Abigail was following Maggie all around the globe, like her little shadow, and introducing herself as the cousin of the bride. "That's not even true," I told Tammy. "I wish she would stop saying that."
"It's adorable, Frankie. People love her."
"She's bouncing around like a pinball. How much iced tea did you let her drink?" Tammy frowned at me.
"You need to understand something about Abigail. She is the product of a broken home. Everyone she knows is from a broken home. Outside Disney cartoons, I don't think she's ever seen a good marriage. But this weekend, she's finally meeting two people who really love each other. She's going to watch them make the ultimate commitment, the biggest promise you can make to another person. To have and to hold till death do us part. You're so old and jaded and cynical, you've lost sight of what those words actually mean. But Abigail's seeing everything for the first time, so of course she's excited. And if you took your head out of your ass for 1 minute and looked around this beautiful space, you'd be excited too."
I waited for her to finish her little rant, and then I said, "Well, I don't think Aiden looks too excited. I think he looks like his friend just died, and everyone's pretending nothing bad happened."
"It's just nerves. I still remember your rehearsal dinner, and you were a pretty anxious groom yourself."
And then she turned and introduced herself to the woman on her other side, because once again she was sick of talking to me. I told myself to calm down and chill out. The fake photo proved that Linda Taggart's story was bullshit. Dawn had never been to Osprey Cove, and maybe Gwendolyn really did overdose. There were certainly plenty of drugs going around the party. Maybe Aiden was genuinely grieving the unexpected death of his friend, but loved my daughter too much to postpone the wedding. All these ideas seemed entirely rational and plausible, so I made a conscious decision to stop worrying and start having a good time. At 4:15, the rehearsal got underway. RJ stood center stage, holding a large hardcover book that appeared to be a Bible, and he coached us through the procession. Abigail went first, pretending to scatter flower petals as she walked. Next were three pairs of bridesmaids and groomsmen, followed by Aiden and Errol Gardner, and then it was my turn to practice escorting Maggie. She'd been cold to me since we'd left the lake, since she'd proved without a doubt the photo was a hoax. She'd asked me, what kind of father would side with a complete stranger over his own daughter? And I had to admit, I felt bad for not trusting her instincts. I suggested we link arms, like I'd seen fathers and daughters do at other weddings, but Maggie said we could save the physical contact for tomorrow. Then she walked very purposefully down the aisle, a half step ahead of me, and I could hear spectators chuckling as I struggled to keep up with her. Up on the stage, I realized RJ's Bible was just a prop
A Harry Potter book with the jacket removed. Now I'll ask, who presents this woman to be married? And that's your cue, Frank. You say, she presents herself with her father's blessing. Then you hug your beautiful daughter, you shake hands with the groom, and your work is finished. Sit down, relax, and enjoy the rest of the show. I joined Tammy and Abigail in the front row, and my sister patted my knee, congratulating me on a job well done.
Just remember to smile tomorrow, she suggested. You looked pretty spooked up there.
RJ sped through the rest of the rehearsal. He assured Maggie and Aiden that he'd go easy on the God stuff, and then wondered aloud if, given the setting, a little capacity humor might be warranted. Everyone looked to Errol for a judgment, and he shrugged.
Just don't go overboard, he said. It's their wedding, not a shareholders' meeting.
Most of the participants seemed too nervous and self-conscious to practice their parts in earnest. The sole exception was my sister, who'd been tasked with a short Bible reading. She asked for permission to rehearse it on stage to make sure she was loud enough.
Of course,
RJ said, inviting her forward with a dramatic sweep of his arm. The stage is yours, madame. Tammy had printed her lines on paper in a giant font so she could see them without her glasses.
This reading is from Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, she said. Can everyone hear me okay? Am I being loud enough?
I gave her a thumbs up, and she proceeded to recite the passage in its entirety.
Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. Love always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails.
Tammy finished with a smile and a small sigh of relief, and for a moment there was absolute silence in the globe, as if the power of her words made all other speech seem frivolous. Then RJ looked to Maggie and saw something in her face that he didn't like. Is it too cringe? Should we try something, more contemporary? And for a moment I worried Maggie might agree with him. But then she shook off whatever was bothering her, took both Aiden's hands and stared meaningfully into his eyes.
No, it wasn't cringe at all. That was perfect.
9. The theme of the rehearsal dinner was lobster night, and each place setting included hand wipes, a checkered red and white napkin, a souvenir lobster cracker, and a custom-printed dinner bib, Margaret and Aiden's wedding, a clause for celebration. The seats were assigned, and I was grateful to find myself at a table with Tammy, Maggie, Aiden, Errol, and Abigail. There was an extra chair reserved for Catherine Gardner in the event that she was well enough to join us. But by this point, I had stopped expecting to ever meet her. Aiden took a seat between Maggie and Abigail, and I called across the table.
I'm sorry about Gwendolyn.
Thank you, Frank.
Has anyone spoken to her family?
Jerry's office is doing some research. Gwen was raised by a grandmother, who's not with us anymore, so they're not sure who to call.
Maggie leaned forward in her chair.
Dad, it's the rehearsal dinner, remember? Can we stay focused? Is everyone having lobster?
Tammy raised her hand.
Yes, please.
Abigail was more reticent.
They look scary.
Aiden encouraged her to try one anyway.
New England has the best lobster in the world. You'll never get a better chance.
And when the waiters brought over our meals, one whole lobster per person, jumbo-size crustaceans with massive foreclaws dangling off the sides of the plates, Aiden patiently taught Abigail how to break apart the shell and pry out the tender meat within. He spoke to her with a gentle tone that was wholly unfamiliar.
I heard him asking patient questions about her interest in world geography, about her favorite mountains, rivers, and volcanoes. It was the most I'd heard Aiden speak to anyone all weekend, except for Gwendolyn, I suppose. He seemed happy to focus all his attention on the little kid and ignore the rest of the table, and the rest of the reception. The vibe of the dinner was country casual. There was a jug band with banjos and washboards, and they performed silly songs about bullfrogs and sunbeams and falling in love under the harvest moon. Waiters walked around with pitchers of beer, but no one was getting too sloppy. It seemed like people had learned a lesson from the previous night's tragedy. Every so often, some joker would start clinking his fork against a wine glass, and others would join in, and the sound would crescendo until Maggie and Aiden kissed. Abigail stood up and applauded every single time. She couldn't believe it was a real tradition. She said her wedding book never mentioned it. There was a microphone and a stage for people who wanted to deliver a toast to the bride and groom, and Errol asked me if I planned to say anything. I told him I was saving my remarks for tomorrow's wedding, and he kept his own speech very brief. He thanked everyone for attending. He acknowledged the absence of his wife and her continuing health problems, but promised we would see her in the morning. And then he raised his glass to the bride and groom.
Margaret is a smart, hard-working, and beautiful woman, and I am so grateful that she and Aiden found each other. I love you both so much.
He finished to a standing ovation and thunderous applause, like he'd just recited the I Have a Dream speech. My sister grabbed a red and white napkin to dab the tears from her eyes.
I always cry at weddings, she told everyone.
Aiden clapped politely, then removed his phone from his pocket to view an incoming text. He frowned at the screen before setting the device face down next to his plate. Then he leaned over to Abigail and asked if she'd ever been to the Grand Canyon, if she knew it was deep enough to hold four Empire State Buildings stacked on top of each other. There were a lot more toasts. In the wake of Errol's speech, it seemed like every capacity employee wanted to get on stage and share a story of how Maggie had touched their lives. And then RJ got up and did 10 minutes of crowd work, gently poking fun at all the married couples in the audience.
What is the deal with mothers-in-law? Am I right?
I had a hard time focusing on any of it. My thoughts kept drifting back to the mystery photograph of Aiden with Dawn Taggart. I understood that Maggie was correct. The photo was clearly manipulated, an obvious fake. But after meeting Linda and Brody, I couldn't believe they were capable of doing the work. Which left Dawn Taggart. She had an expensive-looking computer in her bedroom. It was possible that she photoshopped the image herself. But why? Why invent a relationship with Aiden? Up on the stage, Jerry and Sierra were delivering a joint toast to the bride and groom and sharing secrets from their own successful marriage. And then I glanced at my future son-in-law, sitting silently and wringing his hands in his lap. I could tell his thoughts were elsewhere, that he wasn't hearing a word of their speech. And resting beside him was a key that would unlock the answers to all my questions. 10. After the sun went down, a waitress came around and lit the candles in the center of our table. We'd all shuffled to new seats to change conversation partners. Now Errol was seated beside Abigail and explaining how the miracle battery functioned, while Tammy spoke with Maggie and Aiden about their upcoming honeymoon in Spain. They were planning to spend 2 weeks in the North Country to avoid the sweltering summer temperatures. Aiden had left his cell phone resting face down on the table, and I'd moved close enough to toss my red and white napkin on top of it. Then I looked around to make sure no one was watching, and I deftly slid his phone off the table and into my lap. I excused myself to use the restroom, then walked around Osprey Lodge to the main entrance. Inside the foyer was a long line of women waiting to use the powder room. A few of them smiled at my arrival, and I smiled back before starting up the stairs. I imagine they thought I had every right to be there, as a house guest of my future in-laws. I climbed to the third floor and returned to the hallway where Gwendolyn had found me.
"If you still haven't met Catherine Gardner," she had warned me, "then you don't know anything."
I walked to the door of the master suite and knocked.
"Mrs. Gardner? Hello?"
There was no answer. I pressed Aiden's phone to the black sensor panel, and with a gentle click, the door unlocked. I pushed it open, revealing a short, dark hallway. At the far end were flickers of blue and white light and faint sounds of a studio audience cheering and applauding. Behind me, the door swung shut, and I heard the churn of the electronic deadbolt cranking back into place. I took a step forward, and my foot sank into something soft. It was fabric, some kind of blouse. There were clothes all over the floor, dresses and sweaters, skirts and slacks, enough pieces to outfit a dozen women. I stepped lightly through the clutter.
"Hello? Is anybody here?"
As I followed the passage, I became aware of an odor, a sour, pungent bouquet that smelled like the back of a garbage truck. The hallway ended, and I found myself in an empty bedroom. It was too dark to see very much. All the curtains were drawn, and the only light came from a large flat-screen television playing Family Feud.
"We asked 100 Americans, name a food that reminds you of the human body."
A contestant buzzed in with, "Banana," and the audience went wild, cheering and applauding and stamping their feet while the host pretended to keel over in shock like he never saw it coming. Women's clothing was everywhere, strewn across the floor and most of the furniture. All the items looked new and never worn. Most still had their tags attached, and a few were still sealed in plastic bags. There were so many outfits piled on the sofa, I nearly overlooked the person seated among them. She wore the same white bathrobe that all the guests had in their cottages, but hers was mottled with brown and yellow stains, and she'd neglected to close it all the way. I'd seen photographs of Catherine Gardner online. She was an elegant, smartly dressed woman who sat on the board of Boston's Museum of Fine Arts, and this person scarcely resembled her. She was alarmingly thin, almost skeletal, and her makeup looked like it had been applied by a child. Her cheeks were plastered with a fleshy paste that didn't match the color of her ears or neck, and her eyes were ringed with pink shadow that looked like a bacterial infection. She watched the television with a blank expression, not seeming to comprehend a word of it. The game show host was cheerfully greeting family members and then repeated the survey question to an elderly grandmother.
"Name a food that reminds you of the human body."
"Eggplant,"
she shrieked to the cheers of the crowd, while the host reeled in astonishment, staggering around the set like he'd been punched in the face. And still, Catherine Gardner showed no reaction. I had to move between her and the screen before she finally registered my presence. In a quiet voice, she asked,
"Where's Aiden?"
I could scarcely hear her over the cheers of the studio audience. "He's downstairs, Mrs. Gardner."
"Who are you? What are you doing here?"
"My name is Frank Zatowski."
"You're not supposed to be here. I'm calling my son."
Then she reached into the piles of clothing, burrowing under the garments in search of a phone.
"My daughter is marrying Aiden tomorrow," I told her. "I'm Margaret's father."
She stopped searching for her phone and reached for a table lamp, switching it on to get a better look at me.
"Of course you are. I see the resemblance now. But where are my manners?
Suddenly, she was pushing herself off the sofa, making a wobbly attempt to stand up. The folds of her robe fell open, leaving her naked and frail body completely exposed. With a sweep of her arms, she pushed all the clothes off the sofa, clearing a space for me.
Would you like to sit down?
I forced myself to hold eye contact. Do you need some help with your robe? Catherine looked down and then laughed at the oversight, like I'd just pointed out that her shoelace was untied. She pulled her robe tight and clumsily knotted the belt.
You must think I'm a terrible hostess. Let me turn down the television.
She reached for the remote to lower the volume, but didn't seem to understand. She was holding it the wrong way. I offered to do it for her and turned the volume all the way down.
Oh, that's kind of you, Frank. Now, please sit down so I can serve you something. I won't feel right until you let me.
I perched on the edge of the sofa, and she brought over two tumblers and a bottle of Tanqueray. With trembling hands, she poured the glasses full of gin. No ice, no lime, just pure, colorless alcohol all the way to the rim. Then she sat beside me and lifted her glass, spilling much of the alcohol down the side and over her hand and wrist.
To Margaret, she said. A wonderful young woman.
Her toast was interrupted by a high-pitched pinging. I realized the sound was coming from Aiden's phone. It was emitting some kind of siren to help the owner recover it. No doubt he'd discovered it was missing, and now he was trying to find it. I pressed every button on the surface of the device until it finally went silent.
I hope you'll forgive the clutter, Catherine continued, and she gestured to the piles of tangled clothing at our feet. It's impossible to do any shopping here in the wilderness, so I buy all my clothes online. But that makes sizing tricky. There's endless trial and error. I just want to look nice for the big day.
In the span of just a minute or so, she'd shaken off her stupor to become a lively, animated hostess. She sat across the coffee table from me and took both my hands, like she was afraid I might try to leave.
I'm sorry for hiding away all weekend. The doctors say I need to ration my strength. But now that you're here, is there anything I can do for you?
I'd love to ask you about my son-in-law, if that's okay. The wedding's tomorrow, and I still don't know him very well. At the mention of her son, Catherine brightened.
He's my favorite subject. You can ask me anything you like. I'm an open book.
I want to know about the rumors. And Dawn Taggart. She released her grip on my hands and sank back into her chair.
Well, that's totally understandable. I know what her family's saying about him, but I assure you, he never laid a finger on that girl. He's very gentle, very sensitive, and he'll be a loyal and faithful husband. You've got nothing to worry about.
I met with Linda Taggart this afternoon.
That woman's a fool.
You may be right about Aiden, but I don't think Linda Taggart is a fool. I think she's just confused.
How so?
Linda Taggart made a habit of snooping on her daughter. She'd track the location of her phone, so she knew Dawn was coming here to Osprey Cove. That's a fact. Dawn Taggart was visiting someone here at the camp and bringing home all kinds of jewelry and expensive gifts, so she had to explain where everything was coming from. So she told her mother she was seeing Aiden Gardner. She even photoshopped a picture of the two of them together. Dawn invented a relationship because she was too embarrassed to tell her mother the truth.
Which is?
Dawn was having an affair with a married man. Catherine smiled and nodded, the way a tutor might encourage a student who is making progress in the right direction.
That's very good, Frank, she said. You must be a very perceptive person.
I need to know the truth. Did Errol do something to Dawn Taggart?
My husband? Oh, no. Errol would never hurt anyone. Not with his own hands, at least. But now, if you don't mind, I'm going to have a second cocktail.
I hadn't realized that she'd finished the first. With shaking hands, she lifted the bottle and refilled her glass before continuing.
My husband has some very old-fashioned ideas about men and women. He keeps them to himself, because these days you have to be so careful with the internet and everything. But if you get a few drinks in him, he'll tell you his theories. Errol believes that men are incapable of monogamy. He believes that men, especially wealthy and powerful men, have an evolutionary imperative to mate with as many women as possible. He insists they all do it, all the titans of industry. Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, all your movie stars, all your NFL quarterbacks, and, of course, all your politicians.
Catherine shrugged.
I wonder, Frank, if you think he's right.
I told her I did not. I felt certain there had to be plenty of wealthy and powerful men who didn't cheat on their spouses. But when she pressed me for an example, I couldn't think of a single one. Tom Hanks? Probably. Jimmy Carter? Mr. Rogers?
Well, if my husband had any sense at all, he would use an escort service. That's what all his friends do. That's how our lawyer, Jerry, met his 21-year-old bride. These services will deliver beautiful young women anywhere in the world, even here to Hop's Ferry. But my husband hates paying for it. He likes the thrill of the chase. He needs it to feel like a conquest. The more illicit and forbidden, the better. There have been dozens of women, Frank, maybe even hundreds. I've no idea. I lost track of how many times I've been tested for venereal diseases. About the most humiliating procedure you can imagine.
She reached toward the end table for a half-empty bowl of cereal, a mass of soggy brown flakes and an inch of tepid milk.
Forgive me for eating, but you caught me in the middle of supper. What was I saying?
How did your husband meet Dawn Taggart?
Well, now, that's an interesting story. One evening last summer, Dawn came to Osprey Cove looking for Aiden. My son had already taken her out to dinner because she'd helped him change his tire. But one date was enough for Aiden. He didn't want any more to do with a bird brain. Now, my husband, on the other hand, he was happy to welcome a pretty young thing into the camp and give her a tour. Aiden and I were back in Boston at the time. We had no idea what was happening.
She slurped another spoonful of cereal, and I looked down at my lap so I wouldn't have to watch her eat.
And I suppose he liked having her around because she'd come visit any time he had the camp to himself. Just your classic sugar daddy gold digger scenario. She'd show up with frilly lingerie, and he'd send her home with laptops and Tiffany bracelets.
Catherine held up one finger, gesturing for me to hold that thought, and a stream of thin brown liquid spewed from her lips, spilling over her chin and spattering into the bowl of milk. It was all over in a moment, and then she studied my expression, trying to see if I'd noticed. If I hadn't reacted, I think she might have just proceeded with her story. But the smell of vomit rocked me back in the sofa, and she apologized.
Are you okay?
I asked. Can I get you something?
I'm fine. This just happens sometimes.
Then more brown sludge gurgled out of her mouth, and she held a bowl under her chin to collect it all. She motioned with her finger that she was okay, that she just needed another moment. After she'd finished gagging and she'd cleared her throat,
She pushed the bowl of milky vomit to the far end of the table, so we wouldn't have it resting between us. Are you sure you're all right?
Don't patronize me, Frank. I said I was fine. Now, the problem with Dawn Taggart is that eventually my husband got tired of her. He found some new flavor of the month and decided to say bye-bye to Birdbrain. And that's when she springs her big surprise. Guess who's having a baby? And guess who wants child support? She must have felt like she hit the Powerball. She called Aiden and told him first, said she wanted to talk to me instead of my husband. She claimed that only another mother could see the situation clearly and make things right.
Errol was away on business in Singapore, so Aiden and Catherine were unable to confer with him. They drove from Boston to Osprey Cove on the morning of November 3rd and arrived at the camp just before noon. It was a Saturday, deep in the off-season, so Hu-Ho was the only person working on the property, and they knew they could count on his discretion.
I hated the idea of welcoming this girl into my home, but I brought her into Errol's office, and she showed me her pregnancy test. And then she shared her list of demands, like Christmas was coming, and she could name everything she wanted. Money for rent, because the baby needed a place to live. Money for utilities, for clothes, for groceries, gas for her car, a college savings fund, and then she tallied up all the numbers and hit me with the total. $45,000 a year. I just about died. This girl had no concept of money, no idea what Errol and I were actually worth. Last year, I gave $1.4 million to an aquarium. For a jellyfish exhibit. I've got $45,000 in pennies at the bottom of my purse. But this girl was so entitled, so disrespectful. I turned her down on principle. I said I didn't give charity to whores.
Her voice was shaking, and each new detail seemed to wound her, like she was cutting out pieces of her heart.
I suppose that's when things got a little out of hand.
Now Aiden's phone was ringing. I could feel it buzzing in my pocket, but I just urged Catherine to continue.
Dawn started listing all the things my husband liked to do to her. Really vile and unpleasant things, with my grown son seated right beside me. It was horribly inappropriate, and I asked her to stop, but she just kept going. She was determined to hurt me, and hurt me, and hurt me, until I agreed to pay. And finally, I couldn't take any more. I grabbed the closest thing I could find, this little fuel cell Errol keeps near his desk. It looks like a water bottle. And I bopped her on the head.
You bopped her on the head? Catherine nodded.
Just a couple taps to remind her who she was talking to.
She pantomimed like she was hammering a nail.
Bop, bop, bop. Shut up, you stupid whore.
There was a loud knock at the bedroom door. Someone in the hallway was calling Catherine's name, but I urged her to finish the story.
Well, that's pretty much the end of it. Aiden grabbed the fuel cell away from me, and of course, Birdbrain didn't know what hit her. There was blood in her hair running down the front of her face, so of course she got upset. Aiden went after her, tried to calm her down, but now he's holding the fuel cell. So she panicked. She ran out to the stairs, and then it was whoopsie-daisy and bang, bang, bang all the way down.
Catherine shrugged, as if to suggest these sorts of things happened all the time.
At the end of the day, she was a victim of her own clumsiness. I certainly don't take the blame for what happened.
I wasn't sure a jury would agree with her, but I could hear the deadbolt turning as someone unlocked the door, and I realized there was only time for one more question. Does my daughter know
any of this.
Catherine laughed.
Oh, Frank, you missed the whole point of the story. Or maybe I told it wrong. Did I leave out the part with Margaret?
Yes. What do you mean? I never found out. Hu-Ho rushed into the bedroom, followed by Aiden and a middle-aged woman in nursing scrubs.
Mr. Zatowski, you really shouldn't be here, he said. We told you Mrs. Gardner isn't feeling well.
I ignored him and kept my eyes trained on Catherine.
Please, just answer me. What's the part with Margaret?
Your daughter is a blessing.
The nurse was already rolling up Catherine's sleeve and giving her an injection, and within seconds, her eyelids were fluttering. She said,
We'd be lost without her.
And then she was gone. The nurse proceeded to tend to her with a well-practiced efficiency, while Hu-Ho ushered me out into the hallway, and Aiden followed behind us.
Mrs. Gardner is very ill, Hu-Ho said.
Yes, I can see the migraines have taken a real toll on her. Or maybe she's had a complete and total mental breakdown.
All good reasons to ignore what you just heard, Hu-Ho said. She's in a very fragile place. Her memories are not reliable.
She remembers Don Taggart falling down the stairs and cracking her skull. Was that reliable? Aiden started to answer, but Hu-Ho interrupted him.
We have no idea what's happened to Don Taggart. We've already shared our surveillance video with the police, and there's no indication that she ever visited Osprey Cove. Her disappearance is a terrible tragedy, and we extend our thoughts and prayers to her family and the entire community. Now, I need to know if you're comfortable with that explanation, Mr. Zatowski. And when you answer that question, I need you to be very convincing.
My answer depends on Maggie. I turned to look at her fiancé. She's obviously lying to protect you. But does she know the truth? Did you tell her what really happened?
Aiden nodded. Margaret knows everything. We should have been more honest with you. But she worried you wouldn't understand.
And I didn't understand, because this new information made their entire relationship look like a sham. She said she'd met you on Halloween, at a costume party, and then 3 days later she agreed to lie to the police on your behalf? How does that happen?
No more questions, Hu-Ho said. Let's go find Mr. Gardner, and then we'll have this conversation together.
You find Mr. Gardner, Aiden told him. I'll make things right with Frank. We could have saved ourselves a lot of trouble if we'd just been honest with him from the beginning.
11. Aiden didn't say another word until we were outside Osprey Lodge. He led me across the driveway and into the dark copse of pine trees where I'd met Gwendolyn the night before. And only then did he finally speak.
You stole my phone?
I returned it to him. I'm sorry, Aiden. I needed to know the truth, but I feel like I only got part of it.
You're safer not knowing the rest. I was honest with Gwendolyn. I trusted her with everything, and look what they did to her.
Who is they?
Please stop asking questions. There are lots of different ways to have an accident at Osprey Cove, and you're already on Hu-Ho's radar.
I'm not afraid of him.
You should be.
Aiden glanced around anxiously, making sure no one was lurking nearby.
He used to run the cobalt mines down in Congo, Kinshasa, until the people at Amnesty International caught up with him. My father got him out of the country on a capacity jet. He was facing all kinds of criminal charges. Human trafficking, exploitation of children, workplace accidents. I'm talking real crimes against humanity. He's been hiding here for 2 years, and I still don't even know his real name. I just know he is very dangerous and very loyal to my father. And now he's watching you closely. My advice is, forget what you heard. Go back to the party and just act normal.
Your mother needs help, Aiden. If you don't get her into treatment, and I mean real treatment, in a real clinic, she's going to drink herself to death.
It's too late, Frank. She's always been a drinker. She had to be, with all the sleeping around my father did. But the visit from Don Taggart sent her spiraling. Just a complete and total mental breakdown. Not the sort of thing she can unpack with a therapist. Not unless she wants to go to prison.
She said Maggie's involved.
Here's what I can promise you, Frank. Your daughter is completely safe, and she's getting exactly what she wants. But she is never going to tell you the truth about this wedding, because she doesn't think you can handle it.
What does that mean? What could be worse than Dawn and Gwendolyn being murdered?
And he looked like he really wanted to tell me. But instead, he pushed through the trees and stepped back onto the driveway, returning to full view of all the wedding guests outside Osprey Lodge. A trio of young women recognized him and came hurrying over.
"Karaoke time!"
they exclaimed in unison, swarming around the groom and insisting that he join everyone back at the party.
"Come on, Frank," he called to me. "It's karaoke time. Let's get back to the party."
I didn't follow, and his female admirers showed no interest in persuading me. Aiden followed them around the side of the lodge with the resigned expression of a man being led to a firing squad. I knew my only path forward was to confront Maggie with all my new information and demand the truth. But that conversation was never going to happen on the main lawn, not in full view of Errol and Jerry and everyone else. Fortunately, I still had the map of Osprey Cove folded away in my pocket, and I remembered that my daughter was staying in Hummingbird, all the way on the other side of the camp, and far from all the excitement of Osprey Lodge and the main lawn. I decided to go there and wait for her to come home, and I wouldn't leave until she came clean about everything. I followed a trail into the woods and immediately tripped over a root. This late at night, there was scarcely any moonlight in the forest. I took out my phone, swiped on the flashlight, and used it to help guide my way. The trail descended into a valley, and I passed a pair of cottages named Grackle and Crane. Both buildings were dark, presumably because their occupants were still at the party. And then I walked for a long time without seeing anything, further proof that the map of Osprey Cove was not drawn to scale, because the cottage marked Hummingbird was nowhere in sight. The silence and near total darkness had a way of narrowing my concentration. There was nothing to think about except the next step in front of me, and I felt hyper-aware of my surroundings. Once again, all my old situational awareness habits kicked in. Once again, I had the uneasy feeling that I was walking into a trap, that something awful was waiting just around the bend. Or perhaps something awful was creeping up behind me. A branch cracked, and I spun around in a circle, aiming my feeble phone flashlight into the darkness. I didn't see anyone, but I did see countless places where a person might hide.
"Aiden," I called out. "Did you follow me?"
There was no answer. I turned around and resumed walking. Eventually, I spied three glowing squares on the horizon. They were the small windows of a cottage, softly illuminated from within. I had finally made it to Hummingbird. I climbed the steps of the porch and tried the door. It was locked, but when I pressed my phone to the sensor, the bolt turned and the door swung inward. I entered a cottage that was much smaller than mine. There was scarcely enough space for a sofa, a small dining table, and a tiny kitchenette. Almost immediately, I sensed that I wasn't alone. The door to the back room was slightly ajar, and I heard movement on the other side. I reached into the kitchen sink for an empty wine bottle. I grabbed it by the neck, holding it like a club, and then pushed the door open. Maggie lay on a bed, stretched out on flannel sheets with her back slightly arched, her dress hitched up to her waist. She faced the ceiling with her eyes closed, biting her lower lip and breathing fast and gripping the edge of the mattress. And crouched before her was a pale, fleshy monster with its face between her thighs. I didn't realize I'd dropped the bottle until it hit the floor and shattered. Errol Gardner turned to me with wide eyes and wet lips, and I charged forward, knocking him off the bed and onto the floor. I straddled his hairy, naked torso before he could wriggle away from me. Maggie screamed, and Errol bucked his flabby, sweaty belly, trying to throw me off, but I had all the leverage. I had him pinned. I smashed the flat of my palm into his face, then squeezed my hands around his neck, pushing my thumbs deep into his throat. Maggie kept screaming, but it was just noise. She reached for my shoulder and pulled, and I felt a sharp stabbing twist in my lower back. Just enough of a distraction for Errol to swing out, a sloppy thunderclap to the side of my head that deafened my left ear. I felt concussed, like I might throw up. My arms went limp. I looked up at the bedroom window and saw a reflection of the open doorway. I saw Hujo rushing into the room with a black baton raised high over his head. And right before everything went dark, I realized my daughter had stopped screaming. She was facing the door. She had seen Hujo rushing in, and she hadn't even tried to warn me.